Hello, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Remarkable Women. I'm Danielle McLeod, and I'm the co-founder of Remarkable Women. And in each of our episodes, we tend to meet with women in our community or someone outside of it who's inspired us so much that we want to bring them in to share some of their life experience with us. And some of the context of Remarkable Women is that we believe that most of the women we've researched and spent time with really want to make a difference in the world, but are afraid of the perceived costs, i.e. they don't want to burn out, they don't want to wreck their relationships, they don't want to risk too much security and money, all those things that get in the way of us making bold decisions. And today we have the great honour of speaking to somebody who's made more bold decisions than anyone I've ever met.
Is that something?
Including a year of saying yes to everything, I think, or everything you were afraid of.
Far off.
Yeah, exactly. Who's the incredible Holly Ransom. And Holly runs her own podcast. So I'm super excited to have her on today. She says we've been on her podcast, so it's a strategic move to go second. I'm just so conscious that Holly has this incredible story that no one gets to hear because she's always on the other end of the interview. So talking to Holly, I'm just going to say, like, as an intro to you, Holly, like, in your lifespan, we've got Barack Obama, Gina Davis, Malcolm Gladwell recently. I saw an amazing event in Edinburgh, in Australia called Space, and now a Fulbright Harvard scholarship. And you're 29, right?
Correct, yeah. Getting close to 30 now, not too long.
And I've forgotten to drop Richard Branson in as well. So, blimey, I am so curious. Tell me how it all started.
Well, thank you first for a very generous introduction, my friend. It was far more than I'm due, and I very much appreciate the kind words and as well the opportunity to be featured on the podcast. I think it's wonderful the work that you're doing, trying to grow a community of women who support one another and are pushing themselves to be the best version of themselves. I was lucky enough recently to have the opportunity to talk to a group of young women, and someone put the question to me, what do you wish that we could imbue this generation of women with? And I said, if we could just, you know, there's that phrase that goes around everywhere. It's sort of like, you know, throw kindness around like it's confetti. And I think if we could throw confidence around like it's confetti and just see, you know, every woman feel empowered to step out after themselves wholly and fully, like, the world would be such a different place. So thank you for the work that you're doing to try and grow that tribe. It's a big, big question. Where did it start? Because that implies that it's played out according to a plan. You know what I mean? And I think one of the funny things I was reflecting on with my partner the other day was sort of how the weird and wonderful twists and turns that life takes. I grew up in Perth in Western Australia, which is the world's most isolated capital city. For those who don't know Perth, it's about 3.5 hours on a plane to the next closest city to us. And the moment, I think, for me that I always hark back to, because it was just this moment where my consciousness changed and I started looking at the world differently, was when I was 10 and I was shopping with my mum in a bookstore in the centre of Perth. And telling the story very honestly, I got extremely bored trying to, you know, entertain myself while mum was hunting for a novel. And I was trying to find, I don't know if it's Where's Wally or Where's Waldo?
Where's Wally, yeah.
Where's Wally, all right. So you're on the right side of the coin. The Americans are Waldo. I'd never heard of that, but Wally. I was trying to find Where's Wally on the back page of the Where's Wally book, when it's just that sea of red and white. And I've always been very impatient and very bad with detail. So that didn't last very long. I got frustrated, threw this book on the shelf, wandered out into the street and bumped into a guy that was sitting on the side of the road with his hat upturned that was begging for money. And you might have guessed, I'm not a shrinking violet. So 10-year-old me wandered over to this guy and was like, what you doing? And he looked up at me with this bemused grin, like, who's this kid, you know? And he said, I'm trying to earn enough to get a feed and a roof over my head. And I looked down and counted, and he had $4.20 in his hat, mostly in silver coins. I can remember quite vividly because it took me a little while to count. And I never, ever, ever should have said what I said next. But if you've been a 10-year-old, met a 10-year-old, you know that occasionally one can slip past the keeper. And I said, that's not very much. And thank gosh, to his credit, he was kind enough to chuckle and say, no, this is a good day. I'm doing well. Because I think, hear about that back now, and I'm like, oh my gosh, can't believe I ever said that. So he said, this is a good day. I'm doing well. And I had sort of 2 seconds to take that in before mum dragged me away, gave me a bloody good Stranger Danger lecture. And I got sent to my room straight away when we got home. I lost technology privileges for 2 weeks. All I could think about that night, it was the middle of winter, as it bucketed with rain, was how come I'm lucky enough to have a roof over my head and a stomach full of food, and the guy that I met today isn't. And if he's in that situation, how many others are in that situation like him? And, you know, Australia's often referred to as a lucky country, and in so many ways we are. But that's not to suggest that there is not, you know, extraordinary inequality that is playing out in my backyard. And that was the first moment that raised my awareness to it. And I just felt this passion, like this, not that I knew it by that word, but this firelight in my belly just felt wrong. And I didn't really grow up in a household that welcomed questions like that around the dinner table. So educators and my teachers and my principals play a really important role in my development. And I'm very grateful, primary school and secondary. But I went to school the next morning and I figured the person who had all the answers to all the questions was my school principal. So I was short enough at that point to kind of sneak past the receptionist desk. And just, so I did that and ended up in his office, and I told him what had happened. And I said, I want to fix it. How do I fix it? And I think all the time about how lucky I was in that moment that he wasn't dismissive, that he didn't say, go back to class, or I don't have time, or don't worry about that, that's over your head, or anything like that. That would have closed the door on a line of inquiry that really in many ways has been kind of the pursuit of my life since then, which is this notion of like, okay, there's a problem, there's something I can do, and it can equal a better outcome. And that's the math that made sense in my head. You know, we did a food drive at primary school, made a big donation at the end of term. And I think ever since then, I've been hooked on how do you fundamentally change the dynamics of that equation to exponentially increase the outcome? Yeah. You know, how do you play with it in a way where it becomes self-generating? You know, so I've gone and built microfinance projects in Africa. I've gotten involved in large-scale nonprofit organizations that have a reach and footprint and ability to get a lot of people mobilized around behind change. Now I'm over here studying, looking at policy and government. How do we drive system change better so that we can touch the lives of more people? But it's always been that equation. And that was the moment that came into being for me.
I love that. And it's funny, actually, as you said, because I remember a similar moment when I was a kid of a leprosy mission person coming to my Sunday school and telling this story about how she was working with the lepers and I was saying to my mum and dad, I'm going to be a doctor. You know, clearly that didn't happen. But just being so woken up to, wow, look at all these people in the world who do not have what I have. So, sorry, don't worry about it. So it's no surprise to me that we're kind of hearing this conversation. And though I'm listening to you and I'm hearing somebody saying, I want to exponentially change, which is different to, you know, a food bank drive at the beginning now for you becomes how do I influence global policy, right? And you started in, didn't you do some youth work that kind of elevated all of that for you, government?
I think that's it. Like, it's easy to tell the story in reverse and make that sound like that was a hop, step and a jump. And it's really, you know, it never happens like that. I spent years just working on local charity projects and helping start grassroots initiatives. And a lot of my early work, for me, it was this passion. And again, I think that came from the homeless encounter. I wanted to give voice to people who didn't have an adequate one within our decision-making structures and help improve the lives of marginalized communities. And so for me, that naturally took me into issues that society didn't seem to want to have a conversation about: homelessness, mental health, and groups like Black women and young people who, you know, again, had a direct lived experience, you know, of both of those at the time. And, you know, obviously moving out of the youth category a little bit now. But, you know, for me, it was just these voices that didn't seem to be present often enough at the table. So a lot of my work was in those sorts of areas. And I think always just continually challenging yourself, you know, what do I need to learn next? How do I apply and try and have a greater impact? So it was always this duality of, who do I need to go study under? What don't I understand enough? And that's been the combination of my corporate career and my kind of nonprofit volunteering career on the other side as well. And then I was fortunate enough in 2014 to get the opportunity from the Australian Prime Minister to lead the Youth Summit for the G20. And for those who aren't familiar with the G20, that's a collection of the 20 most economically powerful countries in the world. So they make up about 85% of world economic activity, 2/3 of the world's population. And most specifically, in the context I was working, 1.5 billion young people are in the G20. And having the opportunity to do that, truly, that was the most I've ever enjoyed my work. It's the reason I'm here at Harvard studying policy now, because it made me passionate about policy. It made me passionate about rooms where decisions are made that mobilise and focus an extraordinary amount of resources that are all too often opaque, really, to a lot of us. We hear these things, we see the media photos of the leaders shaking hands or wearing funny T-shirts or whatever it might be. But there's an extraordinary amount of very well-meaning, very well-educated people behind the scenes, you know, architecting some extraordinary deals. And then in certain circumstances, there's a whole lot of people blocking some really powerful and important things. And we're seeing that play out in the United Nations, unfortunately, with the way that US are playing their hands on women's rights and the like at the moment. It's scary. Mm-hmm. And so that for me, this moment of, we were given the brief of, oh, can you basically organise a conference for 200 young people? And I thought, you know, with the scope that we've got, that seems such an inferior effort to represent 1.5 billion young people by simply getting 200 people together and having a conversation. Why don't we try and move the dial and actually see if we could be the first youth summit to actually influence the world leaders' agenda? And so that became this sort of all-consuming 12-month project. Quit my job. I moved to the other side of Australia. I volunteered full-time on this gig of seeing if we could shift the world leaders, specifically on the issue of youth unemployment, because we had to think about, well, what across 20 countries is common to all the young people? Where's the unified point of hurt? And in 2014, and arguably even today, it was youth unemployment. You know, there were riots on the streets of Paris and in London. There was, you know, youth unemployment pushing 65% in Spain. It was just extraordinary the challenges young people were facing getting into the labour market and finding full employment. And so that was the conversation that we led. And, you know, it's summarising a long, long, hard-fought campaign and a lot of great effort by a lot of great people to say that we did in November of that year become the first youth summit to influence the world leaders' agenda.
What I really love about this, and I just, there's loads of avenues I want to go down with you. I'm restraining myself horribly listening. It's like, I've got a million questions. We could do this for a day and we can't because you have a lecture to go to. But I'm listening to this, I'm going, well, here's a woman who's always asking big questions, right? And then I look at something like global policy and there's a path you can take on that, right? Which says, it's too hard. Let me find another way to influence, or it's too complex. Can I really affect change in that space?
Totally.
You're making the choice to say, yes, I believe I can. Where does that optimism, faith, confidence come from for you?
It's a good question. It's interesting because the reason I did my undergrad, so undergrad I did law, economics and politics, because my idealistic 17-year-old self thought, well, if you want to drive change, you've got to understand the existing political, economic and legal structures. And in many ways, that's exactly what I'm trying to do now, is I don't think our institutions and our policy settings are designed for the world of 2019 and beyond. I think there's some of it is. I think some of it provides a good foundation. And I think some of it we've got to fundamentally blow up and start again.
Yeah.
But I'm conscious, you know, both in my age and knowledge of not at all presuming and not being arrogant enough to think that I know exactly how to go about doing that. And so part for what this study is about for me is seeking to build a really deep understanding of how the system works as it is. So I can understand and look at it and go, okay, there's the bit I think I can have an impact on, or here's the way I could pull parts of the system together to drive an impact on this issue. So I think for me that's the importance of doing the theoretical degree. It's not necessarily choosing to opt into the system as it is, but it's seeking to understand it so you can then influence it for the better.
And I guess as a mature student, so I'm just thinking, yeah. I mean, my degree is also, my bachelor's is also in politics. We're not dissimilar in many ways.
Yeah.
And I imagine that as a mature student, there's a different decision making there about how you approach your study, right? Because you're going into this now with a clear outcome defined that you're looking to understand. Because looking back at my master's and my bachelor's, I'm kind of thinking, well, my master's had so much more richness for me.
Yeah.
Not because the study was rich, but because I was in a different place in my own development and I wanted to sweat the content. And so I'm guessing you're making different choices now in the way you study and what you're looking for. And the qualification doesn't mean much at all, does it?
No, and I think that's it. You know, you're so right that it's a huge sacrifice. And we talk about that as our classmates. And I talk about that a lot, that you're giving up a lot to be here for 2 years. You're also enabling a lot and you're incredibly lucky to have the opportunity to do it. Don't get me wrong, but you don't make a decision like that lightly. And to your point, you've got to know why you're here. It's got to mean enough to you and be important enough that you want to take 2 years out of whatever you're doing, that you're prepared to be, in my instance, on the other side of the world from your partner, that because you believe in what it's going to enable you to do afterwards and the impact that you want to have in the world. And so the focus that you bring, it's like, if I'm going to be here, I'm going to be here. You know, like I'm going to be fully, you know, in the books. I'm going to be putting my time, effort and energy into what I'm here to do, but I'm also going to be taking advantage of the extraordinary array of resources that we've got and people that just walk the corridors of this place and happen to be on staff. And but it definitely, like undergrad, I look back and I go, I did it because I got the marks to do it. And I was loosely interested, but I didn't anywhere have the conviction and just the worldview or the perspective on myself, let alone kind of the what was swirling around me and what I might want to do about that. Mm. So I think it is a really, really different headspace, different purpose. It's been a fundamentally different experience so far in a great way.
Yeah. Well, tell me about that purpose, because I want people listening to this to have some context here. You've taken 2 years out of a hugely successful business. You're a very in-demand keynote speaker. You've just run a landmark event in Australia, and you're saying, right, I'm going to take 2 years out to hone down on my learning so that I can, you know, slow down to speed up, actually, is probably the
first. It's not that way of looking at it.
Good grief. That's an incredibly bold decision. How easy was it to make?
What's that?
How easy was it to make?
Oh, look, that's a great question. It was one it's interesting on two fronts. It's one I'd kind of ruled out for a long time as even being possible. So there was a mental barrier for me having to get over that to begin with, because in my final year of university, I was diagnosed with clinical depression. I had a really challenging 12 months. It was objectively at that point in my life, one of the most successful, if you were looking at it from the outside. But, as we all too often know, what can be going on beneath the surface is a really different ball game. And so that was quite a, just a decimating final 12 months, to be perfectly honest. And I think it burnt me. And it burnt my belief in my ability to succeed in those sorts of environments, or that was good for me to be in them potentially. Not that uni was the be all and end all of what I was doing, but it just played a role. And so I think part of it was actually resetting the narrative and being around a lot of mentors that said, no, you would be a great candidate for this. You've got to go for it. And helping me work through that side of it. And then I think the other side was, okay, is now the time? And do I really want to make the call? And the thing is as well, like I applied never believing I could get a Fulbright scholarship. Like I'm so grateful to Fulbright Australia and for believing in me. But that was such an unbelievable surprise. And it's the thing that allowed me to do it. I mean, this is a very expensive education to be coming over here to get. Without the scholarship, it wouldn't have been, something that I would have, like from an opportunity cost, trade off and everything, it just wouldn't have been able to happen. So you apply and you're kind of putting, what's interesting about it is I feel like you're putting your trajectory in fate's hands for a little while. Yes. There's sort of this holding pattern for a bit where it's, and it lasts for about 6 months where you're really not sure where the die is cast. And then you get the scholarship and you've got about another 6 months while you rapidly apply for these universities and you're also in the waiting game. So it's about just over 12 months where you're actually really not sure what's going to happen with the next couple of years of your life, which was probably the more interesting and challenging part, was this uncertainty. Like now that once the moment I knew, it was like, oh, cool, I can plan for that. I know what I've got to do now. Mentally, I've got a frame, understand what timelines I'm working on, all that sort of stuff. I actually think probably one of the harder parts of the decision-making was just how many phases of not knowing there were, given the significance of the actual decision. It was like, can I do business development for my business or not? Because I don't want to do wrong by clients and turn around in 2 months and go, oh, you know that event I promised I could do for you? Actually, I can't, sorry. So it was sort of this holding pattern of like not being able to have a foot in one camp fully, but also not being able to have a foot in the other camp fully. And that was interesting.
Well, I love that, because it would be really easy for people to read your story, listen to you and go, well, here's a woman who just kind of goes for it and makes amazing things happen. And, one of the things people often say to me is, yeah, but Danielle, you're different. It's easy for you. And I'm like, maybe not, right? And so when you talk about the lack of certainty, I go, yeah, common for all of us, right? Yeah. The time at which, it's never the can I change the world question. It's the like, already, what the hell's going to happen in the next 6 months and can I survive it, almost is where the mind goes every time, right?
Yeah.
And is this the right thing? Am I making the right decision, as if there's ever any such thing,
Yeah, and I think you're probably the same. Like for me, I'm a little bit of a different cat in that way, in that the moment I get comfortable and things feel too routine and like they're in too much of a rhythm is the moment I know I have to change something. Yeah. Now, I probably went a little far this time in moving myself to the other side of the world, pulling, like, completely changing my focus, my environment, all that sort of stuff like that. That was a big hurdle outside the comfort zone. But that's kind of my general philosophy. I think the moment I can see kind of the path that's in front of me is the moment I go, oh, no, we've got to change that. There's something not dynamic enough about that. So I always like an element of not knowing. And I was actually talking with a colleague of mine yesterday, and it was sort of saying there's something about that that lets you know you're alive. You know, there's this little bit about having uncertainty or that degree of butterflies. And it's interesting. One of my mentors is a woman by the name of Lane Beachley. And for those who don't know her, she's now a 9-time world surfing champion. And we were talking about this when she won her most recent Masters. She went back and competed in the Worlds last year again. And she was saying that someone told her that fear and excitement energetically show up in the body the same way. So it's entirely your choice as to how you want to interpret it. I was like, I love that, because a lot of people get butterflies and they go, oh my gosh, I'm so afraid and I'm so nervous. And the moment you put that spin on it, that's exactly what those butterflies will be. And every time they show up and you get that gut visceral reaction, you'll feel that way and you'll associate it with that set of emotions. And I just believe in life that it's probably the economist in me. Things tend to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. If that's the trajectory that you're believing for and heading in, the energy you're putting out to the universe, that's the way that you're going to frame and tell the story of what you're getting back, onward and upward, right? Or downward and not. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. And one of the things I feel very grateful for is the year that you alluded to, when my best friend and I did things we were afraid of 365 days. Less because of the things that we conquered, which in and of themselves were very significant, you know, getting over specific fears, more the confidence it gave me in the face of uncertainty. Because that's effectively what we did every day. Every day we showed up in an environment that felt very uncomfortable, where we couldn't control the outcome of how it would go. And we learned to trust ourselves. And we also learned on the days where it doesn't turn out exactly as you want, the world doesn't end either. And there's something about, I think, building that muscle that has enabled new coping mechanisms for taking on a higher level of risk and a higher level of uncertainty.
And genuinely, because that's a big undertaking, and I'm like going, oh, this is really interesting. Would you actually recommend that to people? Would you say, like, and not maybe 365, but like do 30 days of or pick off your greatest fears? Yeah,
I say to people all the time, like, I think the most important skill you can be building right now, or muscle or capability, whatever you want to call it, is getting comfortable being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Like, the only thing we can guarantee about the future that we're heading into is uncertainty is not going anywhere. If anything, it's only intensifying. That's because the pace is intensifying, innovation's intensifying, so we're continually dealing with new and different and ambiguous, and that means having to be able to the degree that you can, because you can only control yourself, think about how you best prepare yourself to show up in those environments. And you know, for me, it's like, you know, I say to people, don't decide. A lot of people talk to me about public speaking. I love public speaking, and I'm lucky, very lucky for that. Most people hate it. And I'm one of those people that's like, the bigger the audience, the better. But I say to people, you know, if public speaking is your fear, that's a really great one to conquer, because it's so important. At some point, your career will hit a ceiling if you don't feel comfortable in front of groups conveying ideas. So what a great one to put on the board to tackle. But don't decide to tackle it by debuting in front of 200 people. Yeah. That's like going into the gym cold and going, you know what, today I'm going to bench 250. Great. It probably won't go well. Secondly, you're going to hurt like hell tomorrow, and you'll probably never go back and do it again. So what we've actually got to think about is, how do we build the muscle? So how do you start really small? Might be as simple as the next event you're at asking a question. You know, it might be as simple as saying to your boss or your colleague, hey, at the next meeting, how about I introduce and set the agenda? Just find these little ways that you can actually start to build, you know, because things like I did an Ironman during my fear factor. It's very easy to say that, like, you did that in one fear factor. No, that was about 57 fear factors. You know, there were so many parts of that journey that were confronting and terrifying and out of my comfort zone. And it was breaking it down into these bite-sized steps that made it doable. And then, you know, when you bit and it went okay, or even times when it didn't, you'd manage the consequences and you'd manage the situation enough that even if, I mean, most of the time it did go well, because that's the amazing thing about it. Like, I always say to people, if it's a fear that you're really terrified of, sit down and write out for yourself the worst case scenario, the apocalyptic version of what's going to happen if you do that thing that you're afraid of. Because the moment you start writing it out, and I journal every day, you catch your unconscious narrative and you go, oh my God, how have I concocted this soap opera in my head? And then give it a score out of 0 and 10 as to the likelihood the thing's actually going to happen. I don't think the whole year my best mate and I were doing this, we had over a 7 in a likelihood score. And it grounds you. It goes, oh, wow, I've just conflated all that in my head. But without catching it, that's driving your emotions. It's driving your decision-making. That's driving your response. You get in fight or flight, whatever it might be. So that, for me, is a really helpful part of the process for things that people are really battling with, is ground it to begin with by not getting lost in this concocted narrative that you've made up about it.
Oh, my women are going to think I've primed you to say these things. Because one of the thing I want to, I love that. I love it. And I get it. My husband's an Ironman too, so I understand that process. I know what it's like. But the thing you said before that, which connects to all of this together, is like the fear versus excitement. Yeah. And we're big fans of Brené Brown over here. I'm sure you are too. We've just very back from Texas, having spent some time with her. Yeah, she's a legend. And one of the things that she really woke me up to was this idea that we experience this foreboding joy, right? And where that took me to next. So the idea that it's all going too well now, it's going to go horribly wrong, right? The brain just
goes down. Crazy thought pattern.
Yeah, and the thing that it made me realise was, as an adult, and it may be a British thing, I never really gave myself permission to be excited about anything, right? Mm. So when you talk about fear versus excitement, it was like, you don't want to be excited about something in case it doesn't happen, right? Which is another version of foreboding joy, I think. So I don't want to get, because I'm not a kid anymore, and if it doesn't happen, I'll need to not show I'm disappointed or anything else. So there's no permission. And so, you know, when we talk to women even about simple things like going for the job you really want, throw yourself all in, right? Like, really want it. And because, yes, you might fall flat on your face, but you got far more chance. Like you've just said, if I'm coming here, if I'm giving up 2 years, I'm all in. Like, whatever happens.
Good point. Like, I was terrified about applying for the scholarship, and my view was, right, if you're going for it, then you put everything you can. I don't think I've played harder for anything in 5 years than I played to get that. Mm-hmm. And played sounds like it's engineered, but as in working at it, like putting the time in, sweating my application essays, sending it to people 20 times over to get feedback, like, you know, getting the best referees that I possibly could to put the best foot forward that I could in the process, prepping for the interviews, getting mentors to run mock ones with me. Like, I didn't just show up. Mm-hmm. And I think it's easy to just show up in some ways, because it always gives you the out, oh, imagine if I tried, whether that's just in your own head or whether that's externally to other people as well.
Yeah.
And that's a cop out, and that's a self defeatist mechanism, I think, that we can easily get caught in. I definitely have done many times over, but we've got to catch and go, if you want it, it's worth going for. Mm-hmm. Like, honor yourself that way.
And I love even what you've just said there, because that's one of the things we love to teach, is that if you're in, like, really do the prep. If you want to, it's like, if you want to make a powerful request, as we would describe it, of somebody, make it powerful, spend time crafting it, right? Because you'll know, as in fundraising, right?
Yeah.
If you just slap out an email that you've spent 3 seconds writing and then go, oh, well, nobody responded, right? No shit, Sherlock, right?
Yeah.
If you actually spend time crafting it and going, right, this is the best attempt I've got at making a request of you, you're in a different game, you know?
Completely. Completely agree. And I think that's it. It's like, you know, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing well.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you win every time.
Yeah.
Like, without a doubt. In fact, I had a run, you know, I almost feel for like a year at one stage where I felt like everything I went for was a knockback. But that's all feedback too. You know, that's the way you got to look at that and go, okay, right, like, what is it? And I look back at those now, particularly in the context of the way that I played my hand in the work I put into the scholarship I've won. And I'm like, oh, because I didn't work hard enough at it. Like, to your point, I thought I was putting the work in. I wasn't. I was doing the bare minimum of kind of what was required to submit a CV or to be a part of a competitive process for a board directorship or whatever it might have been. But one of my mentors says all the time, you know, if you want what everyone else has got, then do what everyone else is doing. And it's like, you know, that's the thing we've got to realize. If you're just doing what everyone else is doing, then there's no extra mile effort in that. We can tell ourselves we worked really hard on it. Great. But think about how you clearly evidence that you're someone that goes above and beyond. Think about how you play outside the process in a way that adds material value to it or the people in it. You know, be generous in that way with yourself and with others for that matter. I think there's a lot more that we can be doing in that regard.
And you just reminded me of a quote from Byron Katie, actually, that says something like, she believes that anyone can get whatever they want if they're willing to get 1,000 no's, right? And yeah. Most people give up after one, right? Or maybe two.
Completely. And you hear all these great stories about the J.K. Rowlings of the world and the like who just kept at it and had this sheer persistence. And I think there's something to be said for that. In fact, the more that I go on, the more that I realize I think showing up is half the battle half the time. Mm. You know, it's that consistency of, are you there? You know, I've said to, there are people that I've got as mentors now where it took me 2 or 3 years to build the relationship. And I was never disrespectful about it, but you know, when they were genuine about their want to kind of connect, I wasn't, you know, forcing myself on anyone where there wasn't evidently that reciprocation, but I was quite happy to turn around and come knocking again 3 months later and say, hey, how's your diary looking this month? Is there any way you've got half an hour? And, you know, for 3 years, one of them I'm thinking of quite vividly, you just keep showing up. And now she was one of my referees for the scholarship process, you know, but it took that persistiveness to build a relationship. And I think increasingly in this day and age where people's time is so precious and there's so many demands on it, we, again, need to be more, like I can tell when a request comes into my inbox that someone doesn't mean, because the first thing I'll do, and it's often quite genuine because now I'm restricted in being in one part of the world, but more often than not, I travel like a crazy person. I'll put it back and say, look, I can't this month, but come back to me when my calendar is clear. It might be a month later, it might be 2 months later. We'd love to make a time. I reckon 10% of people circle back.
Wow.
And that I've really found interesting. One of my mentors taught me that early because he was one of the first I met. I was 19 on a leadership program in America. He was a prolific entrepreneur and he got up and he said to this whole audience, about 500, 600 of us in the room, he said, I will mentor any of you. I'll make any time that you need available. You can come stay at my house. You can, you know, I'll give you everything I've got, but it happens on one condition. If you want me to mentor you, there are 6 books that you need to read. And you've got to write handwritten book reports of every chapter telling me what you took from it and how you're going to apply it. And they're the foundational books. It's like, you know, Think and Grow Rich and The Richest Man in Babylon and, you know, all this sort of stuff like that. And I was talking to him afterwards about it. And he said, I've been saying that to audiences your size for 15 years. How many people do you think have done the book reports? And I was just like, well, who wouldn't want to learn from this guy? This is crazy. I don't know, like 50. They said 6. Mm. I thought, wow, that's how few people are actually willing to put the work in. And I'm not saying it's easy, but even if you chip away at that over 3 years, because you can only do 25 pages a day because of the demands and pressures on your life, it doesn't mean you have to do it any particular way. You do you. But again, if you want that, put the work in. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because this is so important, Holly, because I think you just sharing the effort you put into that Fulbright scholarship application, right? Because it would be so easy for people to go, well, look at her. Obviously, she got it. Look at all the stages she's been.
I felt like that through the process. I can't tell you. I've never had imposter syndrome quite like applying through all this, genuinely, full on.
Yeah. And so you said, I'm just going to knuckle down. I'm going to give whatever I've got to make this happen. And I'm thinking, I'm listening to you saying, you know, 20 people reviewing an essay. I mean, I know the pain of writing my book, for example, and the pain of letting anybody read it, let alone putting it out in the world and having it published was just like, it was like peeling a layer of skin off, right? So letting 20 people read an essay and give me critical feedback actually makes me feel a bit
personal good. Essay. Yeah.
I mean, that's, the message of this is just so clear to me that it's like, just keep showing up. And that's how we move forward. So I want to ask you this, because I know we haven't got much time and I want to make sure everybody hears this. What is your mission now? What's the dream? What do you want to create?
Oh, there's lots of things. I mean, part of what I'm actually here to do is to architect some of it together, because I've had these wonderful parts of my life that to some degrees have always like dovetailed in with one another, but I'm trying to work out what new architecture I build around it to have more impact. So I'll be interested to see the answer that I give you that to that in 12 months when I'm getting close to graduating. But I think broadly, my big belief is all around, or two parts really, like, but a big focus. I'm very lucky to, as you mentioned, be able to interview people around the world and speak around the world. And I'm a fundamental believer that the only way we change outcomes is through changing the conversation. And the only way that we do that is through being able to present ideas in new ways and ask better and different questions. To that end, then empowering different people to respond. I think one of the challenges we've got right now is we've got a whole lot of the same people that have been holding the same microphone for the same time, saying the same things, still grabbing hold of the way that the conversations of the world play out. And unsurprisingly, it's like the Einstein said it well, the definition of insanity is thinking that that combination of things is going to drive a different result. So I'm very interested in how we architect public conversations. So a lot of what I'm involved in, I'm a co-founder of Canada's biggest energy conference. We drive a really phenomenal conversation in Calgary, really trying to change up the players in the conversation there, bring the whole of the energy sector together and say, what does the energy future look like? Similar story to space in Australia, a really different conversation. What would happen if you brought together the most eclectic and diverse group of Australians who believed, you know, fundamentally in the future of the nation, but the need to do things differently to get there? What could that look like? And so I love these experiments where we're starting to play with the bounds of the conversation, getting people uncomfortable, mixing people that wouldn't normally mix, all that side of things. And then I think the interesting thing for me is then how does that start to inform the way that we actually shape legislation, the way that we design policy, the way that we think through large scale public issues? Because we're being challenged right now, I think in general, by the fact that the way that we've gone about it isn't working anymore. I don't think many people would argue otherwise. And that's without even considering the new swathe of issues that are coming onto our plates rapidly, you know, at an individual country level and at a global level. So from my end, it's wanting to be able to play a role in that as well and thinking about, you know, what are the ways that we can try and make sure, you know, that the next generation face or thrive in even greater prosperity than we have. I mean, I don't have children yet, but I want to hand over a world that's a fundamentally better place to them one day. And I worry when we hear in so many countries, and it's certainly the case in mine, that we risk having the first generation who are less well off than their parents. It's not okay. None of us should be sitting, whether that's climate change, whether that's the fact that in a lot of economies, we've done the math in a way that stops working for this generation. Whatever it might be, that intergenerational bargain is not playing out in a way that is good for the world and a way that moves things forward. And I think all of us should passionately care about that and be doing whatever we can in whatever capacity we're in, be that individually mentoring, or actually reverse mentoring, being in a two-way mentoring relationship with someone younger than you, thinking about how you empower people, you know, for opportunities, changing up who you're sitting around the table with and the key conversations you're having in your workplace, volunteering if community isn't something you've necessarily had a footprint in before, but finding ways to make a contribution to that in whatever way, shape or form you can, I think is incumbent on all of us.
I just want to say I'm so glad you're there doing this work, and I'm really excited to see what comes out of it. Holly, I'm really mindful that you've put aside time for us today in the midst of study and everything else. I want to say thank you. I'm so pumped myself. I'm like, I can't wait to get this one out in the world. And I know it's not going to go out for a little while. I often let some of our clients have a sneak preview, and I can already think of a few who I'm going to send this to. So I want to say to people who are listening, you can find Holly really easily on LinkedIn. And every now and then she's there telling us about her Fulbright journey and some of the rest of the work that she's doing. So tune in there for just a little spark of inspiration. And my invitation to all of you who are listening to this is to realize that things are possible that you think just might not be. And if this story gave you just a flavor of that, then I know we've injected some rocket fuel into you today. So if you want to find out more about us, pop along over to www.remarkablewomen.co.uk. But for now, Holly, thank you so much for being with us. And I hope we'll see you again one day.
I look forward to it. Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye.